China waited, catching her breath, listening to the house for any indication that Vess had returned. Finally, she re-entered the vestibule. She crossed the fallen door as if it was a bridge, and she went into the cell. The dolls watched, unmoving and sly. Ariel was sitting in the armchair, head lowered, hands fisted in her lap, exactly as she had been when China had spoken to her through the port in the door. If she had heard the hammering and subsequent commotion, she had not been disturbed by it.
"Ariel?"
China said. The girl didn't reply or raise her head. China sat on the footstool in front of the armchair.
"Honey,
it's time to go." When she received no response, China leaned forward, lowered her head, and looked up at the girl's shadowed face. Ariel's eyes were open, and her gaze was fixed on her white-knuckled fists. Her lips were moving as though she were whispering confidences to someone, but no sound escaped her. China put her cuffed hands under Ariel's chin and lifted her head. The girl didn't try to pull away, didn't flinch, but was revealed when her veil of hair slid away from her face. Although they were eye to eye, Ariel stared through China as if all in this world was transparent. And in her eyes was a chilling bleakness, as if the landscape of her other world was lifeless, daunting.
"We have to go, before he comes home."
Bright-eyed and attentive, perhaps the dolls listened. Ariel apparently did not. With both hands, China enfolded one of the girl's fists. The bones were sharp and the skin was cold, clenched as fiercely as if she had been suspended from rocks at a precipice. China tried to pry the fingers apart. The sculpted digits of a marble fist would have been hardly more resistant. Finally, China lifted the hand and kissed it more tenderly than she had ever kissed anyone before, more tenderly than she had ever been kissed, and she said softly,
"I want to help you. I need to help you, honey. If I can't leave here with you, there's no point in my leaving at all."
Ariel didn't respond.
"Please let me help you."
Softer still.
"Please."
China kissed the hand once more, and at last she felt the girl's fingers stir. They opened partway, cold and stiff, but would not relax entirely, as hooked and rigid as a skeleton's fingers in which the joints had calcified. Ariel's desire to reach out for help, tempered by her paralyzing fear of commitment, was achingly familiar to China. It struck in her a chord of sympathy and pity for this girl, for all lost girls, and her throat tightened so severely that for a moment she was unable to swallow or breathe. Then she slipped one cuffed hand into Ariel's and the other over it, got up from the footstool and said, "Come on, child, come with me. Out of here." Though Ariel's face remained as expressionless as an egg, though she continued to look through China with the otherworldly detachment of a novitiate in the thrall of a holy visitation, her head spinning with visions, she got up from the armchair. After taking only two steps toward the door, however, she stopped and would not go farther in spite of China's pleas. The girl might be able to envision an imaginary world in which she could find a fragile peace, a wild wood of her own, but perhaps she was no longer able to imagine that this world extended beyond the walls of her cell, and failing to visualize it could not cross the threshold into it. China released Ariel's hand. She selected a doll, a bisque charmer with golden ringlets and painted green eyes, wearing a white eyelet pinafore over a blue dress. She pressed it against the girl's breast and encouraged her to embrace it. She wasn't sure why the collection was here, but perhaps Ariel liked the dolls, in which case she might come along more readily if given one for comfort. Initially, Ariel was unresponsive, standing with one hand still fisted at her side and the other like a half-open crab claw. Then, without shifting her gaze from faraway things, she took the doll in both hands, gripping it by the legs. Like the shadow of a bird in flight, a fierce expression crossed her face and was gone before it could be clearly read. She turned, swung the doll as if it were a sledgehammer, and smashed its head into the top of the dinette table, shattering the unglazed China face. Startled, China said,
"Honey, no!"
and gripped the girl by the shoulder. Ariel wrenched away from China and slammed the doll into the table again, harder than before, and China stepped backward, not in fear but in respect of the girl's fury, and fury it was, a righteous anger, not merely an autistic spasm, in spite of the fact that she remained expressionless. She pounded the doll against the table repeatedly, until its smashed head broke and spun across the room and bounced off a wall, until both its arms cracked and fell away, until it was ruined beyond repair. Then she dropped it and stood trembling, arms hanging at her sides. She was still staring into the elsewhere and was no more with China than she had ever been. From the bookcases from atop the cabinets, from the shadowed corners of the rooms, the dolls watched intently, as if they were thrilled by her outburst and in some strange way feeding on it as Vess himself would have fed if he'd been there to see. Chana wanted to put her arms around the girl, but the handcuffs made it impossible to embrace her. Instead, she touched Ariel's face and kissed her on the forehead. Ariel, untouched and alive. Rigid, shaking, Ariel neither pulled away from Chana nor leaned toward her. Gradually, the girl's trembling subsided. I need your help, Chana pleaded. I need you. This time, as if sleepwalking, Ariel allowed herself to be led from the cell. They crossed the fallen door through the vestibule. In the cellar, Chana picked up the drill from the floor, plugged it into the power strip on the wall, and put it on the workbench. She had no timepiece for reference, but she was sure that 9 o'clock had come and gone. In the night were dogs waiting, an Edgler Vest somewhere at work bemused by waking dreams of returning home to his pair of captives. Trying unsuccessfully to get the girl's eyes to focus on her, Chana explained what they needed to do. She might be able to drive the motor home while handcuffed, though not without some difficulty, as she would have to let go of the steering wheel to shift gears. Dealing with the dogs while cuffed would be a lot harder, perhaps impossible. If they were to make the best use of the time remaining before Vess's return, and if they were to have the best chance of getting away, Ariel was going to have to drill out the locks on the manacles. The girl gave no indication that she heard a word of what Chana told her. Indeed, before Chana finished, Ariel's lips were moving again in a silent conversation with some phantom. She didn't speak, ceaselessly, but paused from time to time as if receiving a response from an imaginary friend. Nevertheless, Chana showed her how to hold the drill and press the trigger. The girl didn't blink at the sudden shriek of the motor and the air-cutting whistle of the whirling bit. Now you hold it, Chana said. Oblivious, Ariel stood with her arms at her sides, hands half open and fingers hooked as they had been since she had dropped the ruined doll. We don't have much time, honey. In her clockless elsewhere, time meant nothing to Ariel. Chana put the drill on the workbench. She drew the girl in front of the tool and placed her hands on it. Ariel didn't pull away or let her hand slide off the drill, but she didn't lift it either. Chana knew that the girl heard her, understood the situation, and on some level yearned to help. Our hopes are in your hands, honey. You can do it. She retrieved the workbench stool from the outer vestibule door, which it had been propping open, and sat down. She put her hands on the workbench, wrists turned to expose the tiny keyhole on the left manacle. Staring at the concrete block wall through the wall, speaking soundlessly to a psychic friend beyond all walls, Ariel seemed to be unaware of the drill, or to her it might have been not a drill but another object altogether, one that filled her either with hope or with fear, the thing of which she spoke to her phantom friend. Even if the girl picked up the drill and focused her eyes on the manacle, the chance that she would be able to perform this task seemed slim. The chance that she would avoid boring through Chyna's palm or wrist seemed slimmer still. On the other hand, although the likelihood of salvation from any trouble or enemy in this life was always slim, Chana had survived uncounted nights of blood rage and questing lust. Survival was far different from salvation, of course, but it was a prerequisite. Anyway, she was ready to do now what she had never been able to do before, not even with Laura Templeton. Trust. Trust without reservation. And if this girl tried and failed, let the drill slip and damaged flesh rather than steel, Chana wasn't going to blame her for the failure. Sometimes, just trying was a triumph. And she knew Ariel wanted to try. She knew. For a minute or so, Chana encouraged the girl to begin, and when that didn't work, she tried waiting in silence. But silence led her thoughts to the bronze stags and the clock over which they leaped on the living room mantel, and in her mind's eye, the clock acquired the face of the young man who hung in the motorhome closet, eyelids tightly stitched and lips sewn shut in a silence even deeper than that in the cellar. With no calculation, surprised to hear what she was doing but relying on instinct, Chana began to tell Ariel what had happened on the long-ago night of her 8th birthday, the cottage in Key West, the storm, Jim Waltz, the frantic palmetto beetle under the low-slung iron bed. Drunk on Dos Equis, and high on a pair of small white pills that he had popped with the first bottle of beer, Waltz had teased Chana because she had failed to blow out all the candles on her birthday cake in a single breath, leaving one aflame.
This is bad luck, kid. Oh, man, this brings a world of grief down on us. If you don't get all the candles out, you invite gremlins and trolls into your life, all sorts of bad characters after your stash and cash.
Just then the night sky had convulsed with white light, and the shadows of palm fronds had leaped across the kitchen windows. The cottage rattled in the shock waves of thunderclaps as hard as bomb blasts, and the storm broke.
See? Walt said. If we don't rectify the situation right away, then some bad guys will get the best of us and chop us into bloody chunks and put us in bait buckets and go out in some deep-sea boat, trolling for sharks, using us as chum. Do you want to be shark chum, kid?
This speech frightened China, but her mother found it amusing. Her mother had been drinking vodka with lemonade since late afternoon. Waltz relit the candles and insisted that China try once more. When she failed again to extinguish more than seven with one breath, Waltz seized her hand, licked her thumb and index finger, his tongue lingering in a way that disgusted her, and then forced her to snuff the remaining flame by pinching the candle wick. Although there was a brief hotness against her skin, she had not been burned. However, her fingers had been marked with black smudges from the smoking wick, and the sight of them had terrified her. When China began to cry, Waltz had held her by one arm, keeping her in her chair, while Anne relit the eight, insisting that she try again. The third time, China was able to extinguish only six candles with her first shuddery breath. When Waltz attempted to make her pinch both flames with her fingers, she pulled loose and ran out of the kitchen, intending to flee to the beach, but lightning shattered like bright mirrors around the cottage, the night flashing with sharp silver fragments, and thunder as fierce as the cannonades of warships boomed out of the Gulf of Mexico. So she fled instead to the small room in which she slept, crawled under the sagging bed, into those secret shadows where the palmetto beetle waited. "Waltz, the stinking son of a bitch, came through the house after me," China told Ariel, shouting my name, knocking over furniture, slamming doors, saying he was going to chop me up for chum and then scatter me in the sea. Later I realized it was an act. He'd been trying to scare the crap out of me. He always liked to scare me, make me cry, because I didn't cry easily. Never easily. China stopped, unable to go on. Ariel stared not toward the wall as before, but down at the power drill on which her hands were placed. Whether she saw the drill was another matter. Her eyes were still far away. The girl might not be listening, yet China felt compelled to tell the rest of what had happened that night in Key West. This was the first time that she had ever revealed to anyone other than Laura any of the things that had happened to her when she was a child. Shame had always silenced her, which was inexplicable because none of the degradation she endured had resulted from her own actions. She had been a victim, small and defenseless, yet she was burdened with the shame that all her tormentors, including her mother, were incapable of feeling. She had hidden some of the worst details of her past, even from Laura Templeton, her only good friend. Often, on the brink of a revelation to Laura, she would pull back from disclosure and speak not about the events that she had endured, and not about the people who had tormented her, but about places. Key West, Mendocino County, New Orleans, San Francisco, Wyoming, where she had lived. She was lyrical when the subject was the natural beauty of mountains, plains, bayous, or low moonlit breakers rolling in from the Gulf of Mexico. But she could feel anger tightening her face and shame coloring it when she told the harder truths about the friends of Anne who had populated her childhood. Now her throat was tight. She was curiously aware of the weight of her heart, like a stone in her chest, heavy with the past. Sick with shame and anger, she nevertheless sensed that she must finish telling Ariel what had happened during that Florida night of unextinguished candles. Revelation might be a door out of darkness. Oh, God, how I hated him. The greasy bastard, stinking of beer and sweat, crashing around my room, drunk and screaming, going to cut me up for bait. Anne laughing out in the living room and then at the doorway. That drunken laugh of hers, hooting and shrill, thinking he was so funny. Jesus. And all the time, it was my birthday. My special day. My birthday. Tears might have come now if she had not spent a lifetime learning to repress them. And the palmetto all over me, frantic scurrying, up my back and into my hair. In the sticky, suffocating Key West heat, thunder had rattled in the window and sung in the bedsprings, and cold blue reflections of lightning had fluttered like a dream fire across the painted wood floor. China almost screamed when the tropical cockroach, as big as her little girl hand, burrowed through her long hair, but fear of Waltz kept her silent. She endured as well when the beetle scuttled out of her hair across her shoulder down her slender arm to the floor, hoping that it would flee into the room, not daring to fling it away for fear that any movement she made would be heard by Waltz in spite of the thunder, in spite of his shouted threats and curses, even over her mother's laughter. But the palmetto scurried along her side to one of her bare feet and began to explore that end of her again, foot and ankle, calf and thigh. Then it crawled under one leg of her shorts, into the cleft of her butt, antennae quivering. She had lain in a paralysis of terror, wanting only for the torment to end, for lightning to strike her, for God to take her away to somewhere better than this hateful world. Laughing, her mother had entered the room.
"Jimmy, you nut. She's not here. She's gone outside along the beach somewhere, like always."
And Walt said,
Well, if she comes back, I'm going to cut her up for chum. I swear I am. Then he laughed and said, man, did you see her eyes? Christ, she was scared shitless.
Yeah, Anne said. She's a gutless little wuss. She'll be hiding out there for hours. I don't know when the hell she'll ever grow up. Walt said, sure doesn't take after her mother. You were born grown up, weren't you, baby?
Listen, asshole, Anne said. You pull any crap like that with me, I'm sure not going to run like she did. I'll kick your ball so hard you'll have to change your name to Nancy.
Waltz roared with laughter, and from under the bed, China saw her mother's bare feet approach Waltz's feet, and then her mother was giggling. Fat and obscene and agitated, the palmetto had crawled out from under the waistband of China's shorts and into the small of her back, moving toward her neck, and she had been unable to bear the thought of it in her hair again. Regardless of the consequence, she reached back as the beetle crossed her tube top and seized it. The thing twitched, squirmed in her hand, but she tightened her fist. Head turned to the side, peering from under the bed. China had still been gazing at her mother's bare feet. As flashes of lightning strobed the small room, a cloth swirled to the floor, a soft drift of yellow linen around Anne's slender ankles. Her blouse. She giggled drunkenly as her shorts slid down her tanned legs, and she stepped out of them. In China's clenched hand, the angry beetle's legs had churned. Antennae quivered, ceaselessly seeking. Waltz kicked off his sandals and one of them clattered to the edge of the bed in front of China's face and she heard a zipper. Hard and cool and oily, the palmetto's small head rolled between two of China's fingers. Waltz's tattered jeans fell in a heap with a soft clink of the belt buckle. He and Anne had dropped onto the narrow bed, and the springs had twanged and the weight had made the frame slats sag against China's shoulders and back, pinning her to the floor. Sighs, murmurs, urgent encouragements, groans, breathless gasps, and coarse animal grunting. China had heard it on other nights in Key West, and elsewhere, but always before, through walls, from rooms next door. She didn't really know what it meant, and she didn't want to know, because she sensed that this knowledge would bring new dangers, with which she wasn't equipped to deal. Whatever her mother and Waltz were doing above her was both frightening and deeply sad, full of terrible meaning, no less strange or less powerful than the thunder breaking up the sky above the gulf, and the lightning thrown out of heaven into the earth. China had closed her eyes against the lightning and the sight of the discarded clothes. She strove to shut out the smell of dust and mildew and beer and sweat and her mother's scented bath soap, and she imagined that her ears were packed full of wax that muffled the thunder and the drumming of the rain on the roof and the sounds of Anne with Waltz. As fiercely clenched as she was, she ought to have been able to squeeze herself into a safe state of insensate patience, or even through a magical portal into the wild wood. She had been less than half successful, however, because Waltz had rocked the narrow bed so forcefully that China consciously had to time her breathing to the rhythm he established. When the frame slats swagged down with the full thrust of his weight, they pressed China so hard against the bare wood floor that her chest ached and her lungs couldn't expand. She could inhale only when he lifted up, and when he bore down, he virtually forced her to exhale. It went on for what seemed to be a long time, and when at last it was over, China lay shivering and sweat-soaked, numb with terror and desperate to forget what she had heard, surprised that the breath had been crushed out of her forever and that her heart had not burst. In her hand was what remained of the large palmetto beetle, which she had unwittingly crushed. Ichor oozed between her fingers, a disgusting slime that might have been vaguely warm when first it had gushed from the beetle but was now cool, and her stomach rolled with nausea at the alien texture of the stuff. After a while, following a spate of murmurs and soft laughter, Anne had gotten off the bed, snatched up her clothes, and gone down the hall to the bathroom. As the bathroom door closed, Walt switched on a small nightstand lamp, shifted his weight on the bed, and leaned over the side. His face appeared upside down in front of China. The light was behind him, and his face was shadowed before a dark glitter in his eyes. He smiled at her and said, "How's the birthday, girl?" China was unable to speak or move, and she half believed that the wetness in her hand was a bloody hunk of chum. She knew that Waltz would chop her up for having hurt him with her mother, chop her to pieces and put her in bait buckets and take her out to sea for the sharks. Instead, he'd gotten out of bed, and from her perspective, once more just a pair of feet, he had squirmed into his jeans, put on his sandals, and left the room. In Edgler Vess's cellar, thousands of miles and 18 years from that night in Key West, China saw that Ariel at last seemed to be staring at the power drill rather than through it. "I don't know how long I stayed under the bed," she continued. "Maybe a few minutes, maybe an hour. I heard him and my mother in the kitchen again getting another bottle of beer, fixing another vodka with lemonade for her, talking and laughing. And there was something in her laugh, a dirty little snicker. I'm not sure. but something that made me think she knew I'd been hiding under there, knew it but went along with Waltz when he unbuttoned her blouse. She stared at her cuffed hands on the workbench. She could feel the beetle's ichor as if it were even now oozing between her fingers. When she had crushed the insect, she had also crushed what remained of her own fragile innocence and all hope of being a daughter to her mother, though after that night she had still needed years to understand as much. I've no memory at all of how I left the cottage, maybe through the front door, maybe through a window, but the next thing I knew I was on the beach in the storm. I went to the edge of the water and washed my hands in the surf. The breakers weren't huge, they seldom are there, except in a hurricane, and this was only a tropical storm, almost windless, the heavy rain coming straight down. Still, the waves were bigger than usual, and I thought about swimming out into the black water until I found an undertow. I tried to persuade myself that it would be all right, just swimming in the dark until I got tired. Told myself I would just be going to God. Ariel's hands appeared to tighten on the drill. But for the first time in my life, I was afraid of the sea. Of how the breaking wave sounded like a giant heart, of how the nearby water was as shiny black as a beetle's shell and seemed to curve up in the near distance to meet a black sky that didn't shine at all. It was the endlessness and seamlessness of the dark that scared me, the continuity, although that wasn't a word I knew back then. So I stretched out on the beach, flat on my back in the sand with the rain beating down on me so hard that I couldn't keep my eyes open. Even behind my eyelids I could see the lightning, a bright ghost of it, and because I was too scared to swim out to God, I waited for God to come to me. Blazing bright. But he didn't come. And eventually I fell asleep. Shortly after dawn, when I woke, the storm had passed. The sky was red in the east, sapphire in the west, the ocean flat and green. I went inside, and Anne and Waltz were still asleep in his room. My birthday cake was on the kitchen table where it had been the night before. The pink and white icing was soft and beaded with yellowish oil in the heat, and the 8 candles were all cockeyed. No one had cut a slice from it. And I didn't touch it either. 2 days later, my mother pulled up stakes and carted me off to Tupelo, Mississippi, or Santa Fe, or maybe Boston. I don't remember where exactly, but I was relieved to be leaving, and afraid of who we would settle in with next. Happy only in the traveling, gone from one thing but not yet arrived at the next, the piece of the road or the rails. I could have traveled forever without a destination. Above them, the house of Edgler Vass remained silent. A spiky shadow moved across the cellar floor. Looking up, China saw a busy spider spinning a web between one of the ceiling joists and one of the lightning fixtures. Maybe she'd have to deal with the Dobermans while handcuffed. Time was running out. Ariel picked up the power drill. China opened her mouth to speak a few words of encouragement, but then was afraid that she might say the wrong thing and send the girl deeper into her trance. Instead, she spotted the safety goggles and, making no comment, got up and put them on the girl. Ariel submitted without objection. China returned to the stool and waited. A frown surfaced in the placid pool of Ariel's face. It didn't subside again, but floated there. The girl pressed the trigger of the drill experimentally. The motor shrieked and the bit whirled. She released the trigger and watched the bit spin to a stop. China realized that she was holding her breath. She let it out, inhaled deeply, and the air was sweeter than before. She adjusted the position of her hands on the workbench to present Ariel with the left cuff. Behind the goggles, Ariel's eyes slowly shifted from the point of the drill bit to the keyhole. She was definitely looking at things now, but she still appeared detached. Trust. China closed her eyes. As she waited, the silence grew so deep that she began to hear distant imaginary noises, analog to the phantom lights that play faintly behind closed eyelids, the soft, solemn tick of the mantel clock upstairs, the restless movement of vigilant Dobermans in the night outside. Something pressed against the left manacle. China opened her eyes. The bit was in the keyway. She didn't look up at the girl, but closed her eyes again, more tightly this time than previously, to protect them from flying metal shavings. She turned her head to one side. Ariel bore down on the drill to prevent it from popping out of the keyway, just as China had instructed. The steel manacle pressed hard against China's wrist. Silence, stillness, gathering courage. Suddenly the drill motor whined. Steel squealed against steel, and the sound was followed by the thin, acrid odor of hot metal. Vibrations in China's wrist bones spread up her arm, exacerbating all the aches and pains in her muscles. A clatter, a hard ping, and the left manacle fell open. She could have functioned reasonably well with the pair of cuffs dangling from her right hand. Perhaps it didn't make sense to risk injury for the relatively small additional advantage of being free of the manacles altogether. But this wasn't about logic. It wasn't about a rational comparison of risks and advantages. It was about faith. The bit clicked against the keyway as it was inserted into the right manacle. The drill shrieked and steel jittered spun against steel. A spray of tiny shavings spattered across the side of China's face, and the lock cracked. Ariel released the trigger and lifted the drill away. With a laugh of relief and delight, China shook off the manacles and raised her hands, gazing at them in wonder. Both of her wrists were abraded, actually raw and seeping in places. But that pain was less severe than many others that afflicted her, and no pain could diminish the exhilaration of being free at last. As if not sure what to do next, Ariel stood with the drill in both hands. China took the tool and set it aside on the workbench. "Thank you, honey. That was terrific. You did great, really great. You were perfect." The girl's arms hung at her sides again, and her delicate pale hands were no longer hooked like claws but were as slack as those of a sleeper. China slipped the goggles off Ariel's head and they made eye contact, real contact. China saw the girl who lived behind the lovely face, the true girl inside the safe fortress of the skull, where Edgler Vest could get at her only with tremendous effort, if ever. Then, in an instant, Ariel's gaze traveled from this world to the sanctuary of her elsewhere. China said, "No!" because she didn't want to lose the girl whom she had so briefly glimpsed. She put her arms around Ariel and held her tightly and said, "Come back, honey. It's okay. Come back to me. Talk to me." But Ariel did not come back. After pulling herself completely into the world of Edgler Vest long enough to drill out the locks on the manacles, she had exhausted her courage. "Okay. I don't blame you. We're not out of here yet," China said. "But now we only have the dogs to worry about." Though still living in a far realm, Ariel allowed China to take her hand and lead her to the stairs. "We can handle a bunch of damn dogs, kid. Better believe it," China said, though she was not sure if she believed it herself. Free of manacles and shackles, no longer carrying a chair on her back, with a stomach full of coffee cake and with a gloriously empty bladder, she had nothing to think about except the dogs. Halfway up the stairs toward the laundry room, she remembered something that she had seen earlier. It had been puzzling then, but it was clear now, and vitally important. "Wait. Wait here," she told Ariel and pressed the girl's limp hand around the railing. She plunged back down the stairs, went to the metal cabinets, and pulled open the door behind which she had seen the strange pads trailing black leather straps with chrome-plated buckles. She pulled them out, scattering them on the floor around her, until the cabinet was empty. They weren't pads. They were heavily padded garments, a jacket with a dense foam outer layer under a man-made fabric that appeared to be a lot tougher than leather, especially thick padding around both arms. A pair of bulky chaps featured hard plastic under the padding, body armor quality. The plastic was segmented and hinged at the knees to allow the wearer flexibility. Another pair of chaps protected the backs of the legs and came with a hard plastic butt shield, a waist belt, and buckles that connected them to the front chaps. Behind the garments were gloves and an odd padded helmet with a clear plexiglass face shield. She also found a vest that was labeled Kevlar, which looked exactly like the bulletproof garments worn by members of police SWAT teams. A few small tears marred the garments, and in many places other rips had been sewn shut with black thread as heavy as fishing line. She recognized the same neat stitches that she had seen in the young hitchhiker's lips and eyelids. Here and there in the padding were unrepaired punctures, tooth marks. This was the protective gear that Vess wore when he worked with the Dobermans. Apparently he layered on enough padding and armor to walk safely through a pride of hungry lions. For a man who liked to take risks, who believed in living life on the edge, he seemed to take excessive precautions when putting his pack of Dobermans through their training sessions. Vess's extraordinary safeguards told China everything that she needed to know about the savagery of the dogs.